Chapter 2 Near Twins and Black Sheep. The Genealogy of Elements. Carbon, Silicon, Germanium. Shakespeare had a go at it with honorifica bilitudinitatibus, which, depending on whom you ask, either means the state of being loaded with honors or is an anagram proclaiming that Francis Bacon, not the bard, really wrote Shakespeare's plays. But that word, a mere 27 letters, doesn't stretch nearly long enough to count as the longest word in the English language. Author's note: a simpler but less colorful definition of honorifica bilitudinitatibus is with honorableness. The Bacon anagram for the word is Hi Luti F. Baconis Nati Tuiti Orbi, which translates to These plays, born of F. Bacon, are preserved for the world. Of course, determining the longest word is like trying to wade into a riptide. You're likely to lose control quickly since language is fluid and constantly changing direction. What even qualifies as English differs in different contexts. Shakespeare's word, spoken by a clown in Love's Labour's Lost, obviously comes from Latin, but perhaps foreign words, even in English sentences, shouldn't count. Plus, if you count words that do little but stack suffixes and prefixes together, anti-disestablishmentarianism, 28 letters, or nonsense words, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, 34 letters, writers can string readers along pretty much until their hands cramp up. But if we adopt a sensible definition, the longest word to appear in an English language document whose purpose was not to set the record for the longest word ever, then the word we're after appeared in 1964 in Chemical Abstracts, a dictionary-like reference source for chemists. The word describes an important protein on what historians generally count as the first virus ever discovered in 1892, the tobacco mosaic virus. That anaconda runs 1,185 letters. Publisher's note: for the exact spelling of this word, please visit our website at www.tantor.com. Keywords: disappearing spoon. Author's note: there's some confusion over the longest word to appear in Chemical Abstracts. Many people list the tobacco mosaic virus protein, but a substantial number instead list tryptophan synthetase alpha protein, a relative of the chemical that people wrongly suppose makes them sleepy when they eat turkey. It's an urban legend. The tryptophan protein runs 1,913 letters, over 60% longer than the mosaic virus protein, and numerous sources, some editions of Guinness World Records, the Urban Dictionary, www.urbandictionary.com, Mrs. Burns Dictionary of Unusual, Obscure, and Preposterous Words, all list tryptophan as the champ. But after spending hours in the dimly lit stacks of the Library of Congress, I never located the tryptophan molecule in Chemical Abstracts. It just doesn't seem to have appeared in its full, spelled-out form. To be doubly sure, I hunted down the academic paper that announced the decoding of the tryptophan protein, which was separate from the Chemical Abstracts listing, and there the authors chose to abbreviate the amino acid sequence. So its full name has never appeared in print, as far as I can tell, which probably explains why Guinness later rescinded the listing for it as the longest word. I did manage to track down listings for the mosaic virus, which is spelled out twice, first on page 967F of a brownish volume called Chemical Abstracts Formula Index, January-June 1964, then on page 6717F of Chemical Abstracts, 7th Collection Formulas, 1962-1966. Both books are compendiums that collect data for all the scholarly chemistry papers published between the dates on their covers. That means, contra other references to the world's longest word, especially on the web, the mosaic virus listing appeared only when those tomes came out in 1964 and 1966, and not in 1972. There's more. The tryptophan paper came out in 1964, and there are other molecules listed in that 1962 to 1966 Chemical Abstracts compendium with more C's, H's, N's, O's, and S's than the tobacco mosaic virus. So why aren't they spelled out? Because those papers appeared after 1965, the year Chemical Abstracts Service, the company in Ohio that collects all this data, overhauled its system for naming new compounds and began discouraging excessively eye-glazing names. But so why did they bother spelling out the tobacco mosaic virus protein in a 1966 compendium? It could have been chopped down, but was grandfathered in. And to throw in one more twist, the original 1964 tobacco mosaic virus paper was in German. But Chemical Abstracts is an English language document in the fine reference work tradition of Samuel Johnson and the OED, and it printed the name not to show off, but to propagate knowledge. So it sure counts. Whew. By the way, I owe Eric Shively, Crystal Poole Bradley, and especially Jim Corning at Chemical Abstract Service a lot for helping me figure all this out. They didn't have to field my confused questions. Hi, I'm trying to find the longest word in English, and I'm not sure what it is, but they did. Incidentally, on top of being the first virus discovered, the tobacco mosaic virus was the first to have its shape and structure analyzed in a rigorous way. Some of the best work in this area was done by Rosalind Franklin, the crystallography expert who generously but naively shared her data with Watson and Crick, see Chapter 8. Oh, and the alpha in tryptophan synthetase alpha protein traces back to Linus Pauling's work on how proteins know how to fold into the proper shape. See Chapter 8 again. Now, you'll notice something funny about the distribution of letters in the tobacco mosaic virus. The most common letter in English, E, appears 65 times. The uncommon letter Y occurs 183 times. One letter, L, accounts for 22% of the word, 255 instances, and the Y and L don't appear randomly, but often right next to each other, 166 pairs, every seventh letter or so. That's no coincidence. This long word describes a protein, and proteins are built up from the sixth and most versatile element on the periodic table. Carbon. Specifically, carbon forms the backbone of amino acids, which string together like beads to form proteins. The tobacco mosaic virus protein consists of 159 amino acids. Biochemists, because they often have so many amino acids to count, catalog them with a simple linguistic rule. They truncate the ene, I-N-E, in amino acids such as serine or isoleucine, and alter it to l, Y-L, making it fit a regular meter, seryl or isoleucyl. Taken in order, these linked ol words describe a protein's structure precisely. Just as laypeople can see the compound word matchbox and grasp its meaning, biochemists in the 1950s and early 1960s gave molecules official names like acetyl, 1,173 letters later, serine, so they could reconstruct the whole molecule from the name alone. The system was exact, if exhausting. Historically, the tendency to amalgamate words reflects the strong influence that Germany and the compound-crazy German language had on chemistry. But why do amino acids bunch together in the first place? Because of carbon's place on the periodic table and its need to fill its outer energy level with 8 electrons, a rule of thumb called the octet rule. On the continuum of how aggressively atoms and molecules go after one another, amino acids shade toward the more civilized end. Each amino acid contains oxygen atoms at one end, a nitrogen on the other, and a trunk of 2 carbon atoms in the middle. They also contain hydrogen and a branch off the main trunk that can be 20 different molecules, but those don't concern us. Carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen all want to get 8 electrons in the outer level, but it's easier for one of these elements than for the other. Oxygen, as element 8, has 8 total electrons. 2 belong to the lowest energy tier, which fills first. That leaves 6 left over in the outer level, so oxygen is always scouting for 2 additional electrons. 2 electrons aren't so hard to find, and aggressive oxygen can dictate its own terms and bully other atoms. But the same arithmetic shows that poor carbon, element 6, has 4 electrons left over after filling its first shell, and therefore needs 4 more to make 8. That's harder to do, and the upshot is that carbon has really low standards for forming bonds. It latches on to virtually anything. That promiscuity is carbon's virtue. Unlike oxygen, carbon must form bonds with other atoms in whatever direction it can. In fact, carbon shares its electrons with up to 4 other atoms at once. This allows carbon to build complex chains or even 3-dimensional webs of molecules. And because it shares and cannot steal electrons, the bonds it forms are steady and stable. Nitrogen also must form multiple bonds to keep itself happy, though not to the same degree as carbon. Proteins like that anaconda described earlier simply take advantage of these elemental facts. One carbon atom in the trunk of an amino acid shares an electron with a nitrogen at the butt of another, and proteins arise when these connectable carbons and nitrogens are strung along pretty much ad infinitum, like letters in a very, very long word. In fact, scientists nowadays can decode vastly longer molecules than acetyl 1,173 letters later serine. The current record is a gargantuan protein whose name, if spelled out, runs 189,819 letters. But during the 1960s, when a number of quick amino acid sequencing tools became available, scientists realized that they would soon end up with chemical names as long as this book, the spell checking of which would have been a real bitch. So they dropped the unwieldy Germanic system and reverted to shorter, less bombastic titles, even for official purposes. The 189,819-letter molecule, for instance, is now mercifully known as titin. Author's note: a very few patient souls have posted the entire amino acid sequence of titin online. Here are the stats. It occupies 47 single-spaced pages of a Microsoft Word document in Times New Roman 12-point font. It contains over 34,000 amino acids, and there are 43,718 occurrences of L, 30,710 of Y, 27,120 of YL, and just 9,229 of E. Overall, it seems doubtful that anyone will ever top the mosaic virus protein's full name in print, or even try. That doesn't mean aspiring lexicographers shouldn't still brush up on biochemistry. Medicine has always been a fertile source of ridiculously long words, and the longest non-technical word in the Oxford English Dictionary just happens to be based on the nearest chemical cousin of carbon, an element often cited as an alternative to carbon-based life in other galaxies. Element 14. Silicon. In genealogy, parents at the top of a family tree produce children who resemble them, and in just the same way, carbon has more in common with the element below it, silicon, than with its two horizontal neighbors, boron and nitrogen. We already know the reason. Carbon is element 6, and silicon, element 14, and that gap of 8, another octet, is not coincidental. For silicon, 2 electrons fill the first energy level, and 8 fill the second. That leaves 4 more electrons and leaves silicon in the same predicament as carbon. But being in that situation gives silicon some of carbon's flexibility, too. And because carbon's flexibility is directly linked to its capacity to form life, silicon's ability to mimic carbon has made it the dream of generations of science fiction fans interested in alternative, that is, alien, modes of life. Life that follows different rules than earthbound life. At the same time, genealogy isn't destiny, since children are never exactly like their parents. So while carbon and silicon are indeed closely related, they're distinct elements that form distinct compounds. And unfortunately for science fiction fans, silicon just can't do the wondrous tricks carbon can. Oddly enough, we can learn about silicon's limitations by parsing another record-setting word. A word that stretches a ridiculous length for the same reason the 1,185-letter carbon-based protein previously alluded to did. Honestly, that protein has a sort of formulaic name, interesting mostly for its novelty, the same way that calculating pi to trillions of digits is. In contrast, the longest non-technical word in the Oxford English Dictionary is the 45-letter pneumono-ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis, a disease that has silico at its core. Logologists, word nuts, slangily refer to pneumono-ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis as P45. But there's some medical question about whether P45 is a real disease, since it's just a variant of an incurable lung condition called pneumoconiosis. P16 resembles pneumonia and is one of the diseases that inhaling asbestos causes. Inhaling silicon dioxide, the major component of sand and glass, can cause pneumoconiosis too. Construction workers who sandblast all day and insulation plant assembly line workers who inhale glass dust often come down with silicon-based P16. But because silicon dioxide, SiO2, is the most common mineral in the Earth's crust, one other group is susceptible. People who live in the vicinity of active volcanoes. The most powerful volcanoes pulverize silica into fine bits and spew megatons of it into the air. Those bits are prone to wriggling into lung sacs. Because our lungs regularly deal with carbon dioxide, they see nothing wrong with absorbing its cousin, SiO2, which can be fatal. Many dinosaurs might have died this way when a metropolis-sized asteroid or comet struck the Earth 65 million years ago. With all that in mind, parsing the prefixes and suffixes of P45 should now be a lot easier. The lung disease caused by inhaling fine volcanic silica as people huff and puff to flee the scene is naturally called pneumono-ultra-microscopic silicovolcanoconiosis. Before you start dropping it in conversation, though, know that many word purists detest it. Someone coined P45 to win a puzzle contest in 1935, and some people still sneer that it's a trophy word. Even the august editors of the Oxford English Dictionary malign P45 by defining it as a fractious word, one that is only alleged to mean what it does. This loathing arises because P45 just expanded on a real word. P45 was tinkered with, like artificial life, instead of rising organically from everyday language. By digging further into silicon, we can explore whether claims of silicon-based life are tenable. Though as overdone a trope in science fiction as ray guns, silicon life is an important idea because it expands on our carbon-centric notion of life's potential. Silicon enthusiasts can even point to a few animals on Earth that employ silicon in their bodies, such as sea urchins with their silicon spines and radiolarian protozoa, one-celled creatures that forge silicon into exoskeletal armor. Advances in computing and artificial intelligence also suggest that silicon could form brains as complicated as any carbon-based one. In theory, there's no reason you couldn't replace every neuron in your brain with a silicon transistor. But P45 provides lessons in practical chemistry that dash hopes for silicon life. Obviously, silicon life forms would need to shuttle silicon into and out of their bodies to repair tissues or whatever, just as Earth-based creatures shuttle carbon around. On Earth, creatures at the base of the food chain, in many ways the most important forms of life, can do that via gaseous carbon dioxide. Silicon almost always bonds to oxygen in nature, too, usually as SiO2. But unlike carbon dioxide, silicon dioxide, even as a fine volcanic dust, is a solid, not a gas, at any temperature remotely friendly to life. It doesn't become a gas until 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. On the level of cellular respiration, breathing solids just doesn't work because solids stick together. They don't flow, and it's hard to get at individual molecules, which cells need to do. Even rudimentary silicon life, the equivalent of pond scum, would have trouble breathing, and larger life forms with multiple layers of cells would be even worse off. Without ways to exchange gases with the environment, plant-like silicon life would starve, and animal-like silicon life would suffocate on waste, just like our carbon-based lungs are smothered by P45. Couldn't those silicon microbes expel or suck up silica in other ways, though? Possibly. But silica doesn't dissolve in water, the most abundant liquid in the universe by far. So those creatures would have to forsake the evolutionary advantages of blood or any liquid to circulate nutrients and waste. Silicon-based creatures would have to rely on solids, which don't mix easily, so it's impossible to imagine silicon life forms doing much of anything. Furthermore, because silicon packs on more electrons than carbon, it's bulkier, like carbon with 50 extra pounds. Sometimes that's not a big deal. Silicon might substitute adequately for carbon in the Martian equivalent of fats or proteins. But carbon also contorts itself into ringed molecules we call sugars. Rings are states of high tension, which means they store a lot of energy, and silicon just isn't supple enough to bend into the right position to form rings. In a related problem, silicon atoms cannot squeeze their electrons into tight spaces for double bonds, which appear in virtually every complicated biochemical. When two atoms share two electrons, that's a single bond. Sharing four electrons is a double bond. Silicon-based life would therefore have hundreds of fewer options for storing chemical energy and making chemical hormones. Altogether, only a radical biochemistry could support silicon life that actually grows, reacts, reproduces, and attacks. Sea urchins and radiolaria used silica only for structural support, not for breathing or storing energy. And the fact that carbon-based life evolved on Earth despite carbon being vastly less common than silicon is almost a proof in itself. Author's note, from a PBS Frontline piece called Breast Implants on Trial, the silicon content of living organisms decreases as the complexity of the organism rises. The ratio of silicon to carbon is 250 to 1 in the Earth's crust, 15 to 1 in humus soil, soil with organic matter, 1-to-1 in plankton, 1-to-100 in ferns, and 1-to-5,000 in animals. I'm not foolish enough to predict that silicon biology is impossible, but unless those creatures defecate sand and live on planets with volcanoes constantly expelling ultra-microscopic silica, this element probably isn't up to the task of making life live. Luckily for it, silicon has ensured itself immortality in another way. Like a virus, a quasi-living creature, it wriggled into an evolutionary niche and has survived by preying parasitically on the element below it. There are further genealogical lessons in carbon and silicon's column of the periodic table. Under silicon, we find germanium. One element down from germanium, we unexpectedly find tin. One space below that is lead. Moving straight down the periodic table, then, we pass from carbon, the element responsible for life, to silicon and germanium, elements responsible for modern electronics, to tin, a dull gray metal used to can corn, to lead, an element more or less hostile to life. Each step is small, but it's a good reminder that while an element may resemble the one below it, small mutations accumulate. Another lesson is that every family has a black sheep, someone the rest of the line more or less has given up on. In column 14's case, it's germanium, a sorry, no-luck element. We use silicon in computers, in microchips, in cars, and calculators. Silicon semiconductors sent men to the moon and drive the internet. But if things had gone differently 60 years ago, we might all be talking about Germanium Valley in Northern California today. The modern semiconductor industry began in 1945 at Bell Labs in New Jersey, just miles from where Thomas Alva Edison set up his invention factory 70 years before. William Shockley, an electrical engineer and physicist, was trying to build a small silicon amplifier to replace vacuum tubes in mainframe computers. Engineers loathed vacuum tubes because the long light bulb-like glass shells were cumbersome, fragile, and prone to overheating. Despise them as they may, they needed these tubes because nothing else could pull their double duty. The tubes both amplified electronic signals so faint signals didn't die, and acted as one-way gates for electricity so electrons couldn't flow backwards in circuits. If your sewer pipes flowed both ways, you can imagine the potential problems. Shockley set out to do to vacuum tubes what Edison had done to candles, and he knew that semiconducting elements were the answer. Only they could achieve the balance engineers wanted by letting enough electrons through to run a circuit, the conductor part, but not so many that the electrons were impossible to control, the semi part. Shockley, though, was more visionary than engineer, and his silicon amplifier never amplified anything. Frustrated after two unfruitful years, he dumped the task onto two underlings, John Bardeen and Walter Bratton. Bardeen and Bratton, according to one biographer, loved one another as much as two men can. It was like Bardeen was the brains of this joint organism and Bratton was the hands. This symbiosis was convenient, since Bardeen, for whom the descriptor egghead might have been coined, wasn't so adept with his own hands. The joint organism soon determined that silicon was too brittle and difficult to purify to work as an amp. Plus, they knew that germanium, whose outer electrons sit in a higher energy level than silicon's, and therefore are more loosely bound, conducted electricity more smoothly. Using germanium, Bardeen and Bratton built the world's first solid-state, as opposed to vacuum, amplifier in December 1947. They called it the transistor. This would have thrilled Shockley, except he was in Paris that Christmas, making it hard for him to claim he'd contributed to the invention, not to mention that he had used the wrong element. So Shockley set out to steal credit for Bardeen and Bratton's work. Shockley wasn't a wicked man, but he was ruthless when convinced he was right, and he was convinced he deserved most of the credit for the transistor. This ruthless conviction resurfaced later in Shockley's declining years, after he abandoned solid-state physics for the science of eugenics, the breeding of better human beings. He believed in a Brahmin caste of intelligentsia, and he began donating to a genius sperm bank and advocating that poor people and minorities be paid to get sterilized and stop diluting humankind's collective IQ. Author's note. Shockley's genius sperm bank, based in California, was officially called the Repository for Germinal Choice. He's the only Nobel Prize winner to admit publicly that he donated, although the sperm bank's founder, Robert K. Graham, claimed that a number of others did too. Hurrying back from Paris, Shockley wedged himself back into the transistor picture, often literally. In Bell Labs publicity photos showing the three men supposedly at work, he's always standing between Bardeen and Bratton, dissecting the joint organism and putting his hands on the equipment, forcing the other two to peer over his shoulders like mere assistants. Those images became the new reality, and the general scientific community gave credit to all three men. Shockley also, like a petty prince in a fiefdom, banished his main intellectual rival, Bardeen, to another unrelated lab so that he, Shockley, could develop a second and more commercially friendly generation of germanium transistors. Unsurprisingly, Bardeen soon quit Bell Labs to take an academic post in Illinois. He was so disgusted, in fact, that he gave up semiconductor research. Things turned sour for germanium, too. By 1954, the transistor industry had mushroomed. The processing power of computers had expanded by orders of magnitude, and whole new product lines, such as pocket radios, had sprung up. But throughout the boom, engineers kept ogling silicon. Partly they did so because germanium was temperamental. As a corollary of conducting electricity so well, it generated unwanted heat too, causing germanium transistors to stall at high temperatures. More important, silicon, the main component of sand, was perhaps even cheaper than proverbial dirt. Scientists were still faithful to germanium, but they were spending an awful lot of time fantasizing about silicon. Suddenly, at a semiconductor trade meeting that year, a cheeky engineer from Texas got up after a gloomy speech about the unfeasibility of silicon transistors and announced that he actually had one in his pocket. Would the crowd like a demonstration? This P.T. Barnum, whose real name was Gordon Teal, then hooked up a germanium-run record player to external speakers and, rather medievally, lowered the player's innards into a vat of boiling oil. As expected, it choked and died. After fishing the innards out, Teal popped out the germanium transistor and rewired the record player with his silicon one. Once again, he plopped it into the oil. The band played on. By the time the stampede of salesmen reached the payphones at the back of the convention hall, germanium had been dumped. Luckily for Bardeen, his part of the story ended happily if clumsily. His work with germanium semiconductors proved so important that he, Bratton, and, sigh, Shockley, all won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1956. Bardeen heard the news on his radio, by then probably silicon run, while frying breakfast one morning. Flustered, he knocked the family's scrambled eggs onto the floor. It was not his last Nobel-related gaffe. Days before the prize ceremony in Sweden, he washed his formal white bow tie and vest with some colored laundry and stained them green, just as one of his undergrad students might have. And on the day of the ceremony, he and Bratton got so wound up about meeting Sweden's King Gustav I that they chugged quinine to calm their stomachs. It probably didn't help when Gustav chastened Bardeen for making his son stay in class back at Harvard. Bardeen was afraid they might miss a test, instead of coming to Sweden with him. At this rebuke, Bardeen tepidly joked that, ha-ha, he'd bring them along the next time he won the Nobel Prize. Gaffes aside, the ceremony marked a high point for semiconductors, but a brief one. The Swedish Academy of Sciences, which hands out the Nobel Prizes in Chemistry and Physics, tended at the time to honor pure research over engineering, and the win for the transistor was an uncommon acknowledgement of applied science. Nevertheless, by 1958, the transistor industry faced another crisis. And with Bardeen out of the field, the door stood open for another hero. Although he probably had to stoop, he stood 6'6", Jack Kilby soon walked through it. A slow-talking Kansan with a leathery face, Kilby had spent a decade in the high-tech boondocks, Milwaukee, before landing a job at Texas Instruments, TI, in 1958. Though trained in electrical engineering, Kilby was hired to solve a computer hardware problem known as the tyranny of numbers. Basically, though cheap silicon transistors worked okay, fancy computer circuits required scores of them. That meant companies like TI had to employ whole hangars of low-paid, mostly female technicians who did nothing all day but crouch over microscopes, swearing and sweating in hazmat suits as they soldered silicon bits together. In addition to being expensive, this process was inefficient. In every circuit, one of those frail wires inevitably broke or worked loose and the whole circuit died. Yet engineers couldn't get around the need for so many transistors. The tyranny of numbers. Kilby arrived at TI during a sweltering June. As a new employee, he had no vacation time, so when the cast of thousands cleared out for mandatory vacations in July, he was left alone at his bench. The relief of silence no doubt convinced him that employing thousands of people to wire transistors together was asinine, and the absence of supervisors gave him free time to pursue a new idea he called an integrated circuit. Silicon transistors weren't the only parts of a circuit that had to be hand-wired. Carbon resistors and porcelain capacitors also had to be spaghettied together with copper wire. Kilby scrapped that separate element setup and instead carved everything, all the resistors, transistors, and capacitors, from one firm block of semiconductor. It was a smashing idea. The difference, structurally and artistically, between sculpting a statue from one block of marble and carving each limb separately, then trying to fit the statue together with wire. Not trusting the purity of silicon to make the resistors and capacitors, he turned to germanium for his prototype. Ultimately, this integrated circuit freed engineers from the tyranny of hand wiring. Because the pieces were all made of the same block, no one had to solder them together. In fact, soon no one even could have soldered them together, because the integrated circuit also allowed engineers to automate the carving process and make microscopic sets of transistors, the first real computer chips. Kilby never received full credit for his innovation. One of Shockley's protégés filed a rival and slightly more detailed patent claim a few months later and wrestled the rights away from Kilby's company. But geeks today still pay Kilby the ultimate engineering tribute. In an industry that measures product cycles in months, chips are still made using his basic design 50 years later. And in 2000, he won a belated Nobel Prize for his integrated circuit. Sadly, though, nothing could resurrect germanium's reputation. Kilby's original germanium circuit is ensconced in the Smithsonian Institution, but in the bare-knuckle marketplace, germanium got pummeled. Silicon was too cheap and too available. Sir Isaac Newton famously said that he had achieved everything by standing on the shoulders of giants, the scientific men whose findings he built upon. The same might be said about silicon. After germanium did all the work, silicon became an icon, and germanium was banished to periodic table obscurity. In truth, that's a common fate regarding the periodic table. Most elements are undeservedly anonymous. Even the names of the scientists who discovered many of them and who arranged them into the first periodic tables have long since been forgotten. Yet like silicon, a few names have achieved universal fame, and not always for the best reasons. All of the scientists working on early periodic tables recognized likenesses among certain elements. Chemical triads, like the modern-day example of carbon, silicon, and germanium, were the first clue that the periodic system existed. But some scientists proved more facile than others at recognizing subtleties. The traits that run through the families of the periodic table like dimples or crooked noses in humans. Knowing how to trace and predict such similarities soon allowed one scientist, Dmitri Mendeleev, to vault into history as the father of the periodic table.